Welcome to Idle Red Hands, a podcast from Japan about gaming and gamer life.
And welcome to Idle Red Hands. I'm Chris.
I'm Wayne.
I'm Lyle. Welcome back, Wayne.
He's back.
Thank you. Thank you. It's good to be back. I missed you guys.
So any highlights from your trip?
Got to watch a lot of bad movies on the plane ride over and back.
I don't think you know what the meaning of highlight is.
Apparently not.
Highlight.
What are you talking about? He gets to complain about them now. That's
right,
great for
right.
Him.
We've been over this before. There's a very thin line, non-existent, between stuff I like and stuff I hate.
I guess you don't listen to the episodes you're not on, but we did reveal that you were on Happy Jacks.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay.
So you can mention that.
Yeah, that was a highlight. Although, yeah, not as crazy as expected due to the time change.
Because you weren't drinking?
Right.
Yeah, okay.
Because we all know how I get when I drink.
How do you get when
you drink?
Sleepy.
You must have been awesome on that podcast.
Yeah.
So what did you talk about on Happy Jacks?
We just did the usual read listener emails, and I was good and, you know, didn't proselytize Dungeon World, you know, every chance I got, which is what people thought I would do. Mm. But I was good and didn't. So.
Okay.
Right on.
Yeah.
All right, you really want to talk about these bad movies, don't you? You're just like, yeah, we did the usual. I didn't do that. Anyway, go ahead, Wayne.
No.
Tell us about these bad movies.
No. It wasn't like I was chomping at the bit to, but.
Don't make us beg.
All right. I'm waiting. Do it. Now, it was Transformers 4, which I'm glad we went to see Godzilla as opposed to that, because, oh man, there's not enough alcohol in the world to make that a worthwhile movie. Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, same goes for that. Lucy, which we were just talking about, which I didn't think was all that good. And what else? Oh, Expendables 3. Which I got about half an hour into, and I'm like, I'm done with this.
Jeez, every single one of these movies you're mentioning, it's like, there was a Transformers 4, there was an Expendables 3.
Yeah. How to Train Your Dragon 2 was good.
Oh, cool. So. Yeah, the first one, that was great, so.
Yeah.
It was okay. Yeah, I didn't mind that.
Yeah, definitely for kids, but I mean, like, still good. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
You know the listener that gave me crap for my reviews of movies?
Right.
Hope he gives you crap for that.
Well, sorry, I didn't know I was actually reviewing. I was just mentioning ones that I saw.
Tell me why you think that. No, it's okay. Yeah. But you said something that might be interesting for this podcast about Lucy, and that it was similar to Dungeons & Dragons Book of Vile Darkness, which was Dungeons & Dragons 3.
Right. No, because when we saw that, you mentioned, Lyle, that... Yeah, Dungeons & Dragons 3, Book of Vile Darkness is probably like a role-playing game plot, where if you were playing that story, you would think it was pretty good. But then you watch it as a movie, and, you know, the clues are kind of too obvious, or just things are too kind of black and white, and you kind of know what's going to happen. And watching it as a movie, it's not very good. So I kind of thought Lucy was the same thing. Like, things felt kind of rushed or just a bit disjointed. But if you were playing that as a role-playing game or the plot of a game, it would probably be pretty decent.
Hmm.
But as a movie, no, not really that great.
Yeah, it reminds me, sounds like Clash of the Titans, where
you
watch that and you think, okay, I can see how these scenes or these set pieces add up to a decent game.
Mm-hmm. Right.
There's a progression, but it doesn't make for a decent movie, especially when you kill off all the interesting characters halfway through.
Yeah. Oh, you're talking about the remake, right.
Yeah.
Is Lucy worth watching as a, like, idea fodder for games?
Oh, yeah, sure. Like, there were interesting ideas, and, like, the premise I thought was decent, kind of the how it happens, the setup just to kick off the action,
mm-hmm.
You know, was decent. But, yeah, certain parts just felt really short.
Hmm.
You know? So, yeah.
Cool.
It's worth watching, checking out, you know.
I will then.
So this episode is going to be a wrap-up of 2014, or 2014 as far as, like, games and geek culture goes. So we'll go through what we thought were the big things and their impact.
Yeah.
Yep.
So what's first on our list?
Well, I suppose since we were talking about movies, there are some pretty good movies out this year, especially geeky movies, like Guardians of the Galaxy.
Yeah, which we all saw together.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so, which probably elevated it for us, but some takeaways from Guardians of the Galaxy. I think one of them is it proves the power of the Marvel brand.
Right.
And that most people didn't know who Guardians of the Galaxy were. And I'd read Annihilation where they reintroduced them, but I wasn't like excited to see these guys in a movie.
Mm-hmm.
But people flocked to Guardians of the Galaxy because it was Marvel and somehow connected to this mega story.
So. Yeah, yeah, yeah. We've established that neither Chris nor I are really comic book people. So, I had never heard of these characters before.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, just kind of go to have a good time. I thought the movie was decent. But, yeah, you're right. The amount of hype and the amount of, you know, oh, my God, this movie is awesome. This is the greatest movie ever, blah, 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 or at least the greatest movie of the year. That, again, I was seeing on social media since Japan released it, what, like a month after everyone else got it? So you see all the hype and the build-up, and yeah, that did prove to me exactly what you said, Lyle, that the strength of Marvel as a brand was pretty undisputed, or people would go see probably anything with the Marvel tag on it.
But I mean, really, they've put out so many of these superhero movies now, and you know, there's some that weren't as good as others, but I don't think there's any of them that I would call a bad movie.
I didn't say any of them were bad.
Well, exactly. I'm trying to support your point because I think Marvel has built up a pretty good brand in that they've released a lot of really good films.
Yeah, but I think at this point they could probably release anything.
And they're going to test that.
Yeah,
they're going to release Ant-Man.
Yeah, there you go.
And people are going crazy about Doctor Strange and going perfect casting for Doctor Strange. That's really incredible. But Doctor Strange comics die. Like, after the 70s, they really could not keep him going. Defenders comics, which had Doctor Strange in them, and then some other characters took over, but they couldn't keep that comic book going.
Hmm.
Yeah, I don't know. Is it the power of nostalgia? Is it the power of, just Marvel? So I think it's both good and bad. And the good is that they're going to take some risks, and they'll release characters that aren't lesser known, so maybe they can tell different stories, like Guardians of the Galaxy did seem a little bit fresher than watching Avengers or the third Iron Man.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And then they'll release characters like Ant-Man or Doctor Strange, so maybe the expectations on what you should see are going to be lower.
Well,
because people are going to be less familiar with Ant-Man and less familiar with Doctor Strange, so they can do more with them.
I wonder if what you just said there about nostalgia, I wonder if that's might actually be working against them. Because in the case of something like Captain America, so many people know that story that maybe there's things that you kind of have to hit to get those fan expectations. But if you release something like Ant-Man, I mean, who's Ant-Man? Nobody knows enough about him to, except for the diehard comic book fans, of course, to really have that high expectations of what's going to be contained in the story.
But I wonder if that mass fan appeal means they can be more lenient with the story, or you know, whereas, you know, Ant-Man, Doctor Strange, as Lionel said, like, those are lesser known characters, so people who do know those storylines are going to be like the rabid diehard fans, and will they be less forgiving if you deviate from the story because of that kind of, you know, smaller group? I don't know.
No, they're going to be grateful.
Well, probably.
Thank you. Thank you for Ant-Man.
I will watch anything you do.
You know that's not true, Lyle. Nerds are never grateful. We're angry, angry people.
Right.
I think so. Definitely there could be two ways to view it, but I would side on they can be more creative and take more license and say, this is the Doctor Strange of the movie world, so deal with it.
And I hope they do.
Yeah, and he's not going to wear a blue satin shirt.
Oh, come on.
Nah, I'm kidding, still.
Yeah. No, that's true. Like, I do think the Marvel line is able to take risks because they do have that fan base now. And yeah, people will probably go see anything put out, even if it's Ant-Man or Doctor Strange.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
So Marvel is like a new brand, but if we look at a movie backed by an old brand, and Tom Cruise, or just movie star power in general, and that did not do as well, or underperformed, as they say. But that was a solid movie. I would say it was a superior movie to Guardians of the Galaxy.
Yeah, and I would agree, yeah.
Yeah, but I'm wondering then if you need that nostalgia, or you need something else, or other properties, other licenses to support kind of a science fiction, or I'll say kind of a more geeky style movie. Whereas this has, it's a science fiction movie, a little bit of thinking, but not too much. It's very much an action science fiction movie, and why that wouldn't attract everybody, why there wouldn't be as much hype.
That's a really interesting point, because, you know, you're talking about kind of Marvel's brand power. I mean, I don't know if Tom Cruise maybe has less brand power now than he did in the past, because Guardians of the Galaxy was a sci-fi movie just like Edge of Tomorrow was, so I don't think it has to do with the genre there. I wonder if it has to do with the brand, or maybe just the way that they were marketed.
I guess my question is the genre shifting?
Mm.
Like, if you want to see a movie like Blade Runner these days, it's going to have to be Blade Runner 2. Because of that nostalgia factor and hype. And I actually think Wayne brought a really good point. I wanted to say something about that and about the hype. And because we get movies sometimes at the same time, but often like a month, 2 months, 3 months, or 6 months after a movie,
right.
We very much get the hype, and both the pre-movie hype and then the post-movie hype. So we heard a lot about the Avengers and Guardians of the Galaxy, people saying it's the best movie ever made.
Mm.
And then with Edge of Tomorrow, it was almost nothing.
Yeah, yeah.
And even though it's based off of a Japanese comic book, All You Need Is Kill.
Mm-hmm.
Right, which is what it was called here, yeah. And, like, you're exactly right, Lyle. Like, Guardians of the Galaxy, people were like, this is fantastic, greatest movie of the summer. And what I saw with Edge of Tomorrow is people saying, okay, everyone says they want original science fiction movies and is tired of franchise stuff. So go vote with your wallet and go see Edge of Tomorrow, because that's what that movie is. And I guess hearing you say that it didn't do that well in the box office then, Lyle, people didn't do that. So they pay lip service to the fact of, oh, I'm tired of these franchise movies, or, you know, Transformers 2, 3, 4, Blade Runner 2, or, you know, these reboots. People are saying that, but they're not following it up.
Oh, I agree with that 100%. And what we were hearing from Edge of Tomorrow, the post-release hype was, it was underrated. But I guess there were just tiny voices in the ether, because people are saying that this is a very underrated film, and that it should get more recognition, but it wasn't drawing people to the theaters. Yeah. And if you look at, because we were doing some research just about box office draws, if you look at Mojo Box Office online.
Okay.
And it lists, like, the top grossing movies, Avatar number one. But you look, it's always the sequels that will do much better than the number one. So Iron Man 3 is the top grossing Iron Man.
Huh.
Hmm.
Even though, I guess you could say it's the second best of the series. I would say Iron Man number one is the best.
Mm-hmm.
Except for Phantom Menace, which seemed to kill that trilogy.
Right. I wonder if that's because, it's definitely because there's another movie people are like, oh yeah, I remember that. Let's check out number two.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
But I wonder if it's also because the studio can say, well, we have a lot of the costumes and the cast, so it's not like we have to like entice new people to come in for the most part. It's like, do you want to do another one of these?
Well, I mean, I'm pretty sure that the studio's reckoning on everything is just how much money it's going to make. I don't think it has really matters how easy or difficult of a film it is to do.
No, but that's what I mean. Like, the studio, they know they have this talent who will probably be willing to do it. So I'm wondering
they sign them for trilogies.
Yeah. Yeah,
it's not that they're willing. They're contractually obligated to do it. It's very rare to sign them if it's like a property like that, to sign them for less than three pictures.
Right. They usually pay the stars well enough to be able to take three pictures, even if they don't continue the series on. They want to be able to keep that sequel power.
And I could be wrong, but I think often their salaries increase with each movie.
Hmm.
But I wonder if the budget then does too, because the studio can say, look, this is how much we got for number one. Sequels always do better, always make more.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Well, Roger Corman, the famous schlock director and producer, but somebody like people like Ron Howard got their start working for Roger Corman.
Mm.
But he was saying when a Jurassic Park came out, so his studio released, I'm going to say Carnosaurus.
Okay.
But I can't remember exactly the name. It was a dinosaur movie.
I think Carnosaur. I think I've seen that actually.
Carnosaur, okay. And he was just saying is what you do is you just keep releasing movies, Carnosaur 2, Carnosaur 3, until it drops.
Mm-hmm.
But you get about two or three out, and they increase. And then when they were not increasing anymore, then you start to consider cutting the series.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I think it's just people are familiar. And I think it really reinforces your point, Wayne, is like people say they want original movies and original science fiction or original fantasy, but they're not supporting it with their dollars.
Yeah, they're not proving it. It's only lip service.
Part of the sequel thing might be that people become familiar with something. Like, for example, Edge of Tomorrow. It's spread to all of us now through word of mouth, mostly through your recommendations, Lyle. At least that's why I'm going to see it, is because you've mentioned it now. So if Edge of Tomorrow 2 comes out at some point, then I'll have already seen Edge of Tomorrow, so I'll be familiar with the franchise, know what I'm getting, and then be more likely to see a sequel.
Yeah. Yeah. And not giving any spoilers, Edge of Tomorrow 2 would probably suck.
Yeah, but it also maybe that's one of the reasons why I watched it, and you watch it and you go, okay, that's movies self-contained, you know.
Yeah.
They're not setting up, and I think that's a good lead into another big movie event, or kind of mixed on this one, but the Hobbit Battle of the Five Armies.
Yes.
And actually this they think might not perform as well as the previous two movies.
Oh really?
Or it's performing less than them overall. And one of the reasons could be is that was really obviously a padded out series.
Mm, yeah.
Where people felt it was overly long and they were just stretching out what was originally planned as two movies, and they decided to make it three movies, and they could actually see that on the screen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. I agree. We talked about it before about how long the other two movies felt, and that's exactly how it felt. When the Lord of the Rings movies came out sequentially, I was excited about those coming out. And The Hobbit, I do want to see it, as I said before, but you can see it later, you know, next month, that's fine.
Yeah, exactly. I was like, okay, great, Hobbit movie. And like, what? It's three movies? Seriously, how are they do that? So, yeah, I think you're right. Like, I don't know how well the third movie is going to do. And if it does poorly, it's probably because people are like, you didn't have to do it this way.
Well, relatively poorly anyway. It's still top of the box office rates right now.
Okay. It's made, I mean, they often don't report their marketing budget
when they
do how much it costs to make. But it's made back, I think it made back its money in the first 5 days or something.
Mm-hmm. Fair enough. That,
but still, that
kind
was
of unexpected.
Yeah.
You know, something being the top of the box office is the way I look at something as being a bestseller. Like, every new movie that comes out is top of the box office for some time, you know?
Yeah, and whether it can sustain it over 2 weeks or three weeks, then that's like, oh, that's a hit.
Yeah.
Yeah, but why this is a big story for us and why we put it on the list, even though we just talked about it underperforming, and I actually thought it was the best of the three, but we were talking about whether or not this is the last Tolkien movie that we're going to see.
Because that was the way they were advertising the TV commercials back in when I was in California. It was, you know, visit Middle Earth one last time. And you know, I'm sitting there thinking, they're not going to let that cash cow die.
Yeah. In a world that you already know really well.
Right.
So what do you guys think? Do you think it's going to...
No, not a chance in heck.
Well, that answers that. Yeah. Yeah, I said I was willing to bet a small amount of money that... we would see something related to the Silmarillion.
I think, and I said prior to the podcast, you heard it here first, and then Wayne said, well, I heard it somewhere else. Yeah. I think they might look at a Tolkien TV series.
And I would be so excited by that.
Which might focus, and then we're kind of discussing what they would focus on, you know, the Silmarillion, but maybe stories from the Second Age, because that would be most familiar to people.
Mm. Right, as opposed to the First Age, which is just kind of like the angels. But
right.
Yeah, yeah, angels and then the men coming in. And
yeah, I think you still need a bit of a grounding in the Tolkien series. You have, you know, the Bilbo or Frodo characters who are more down-to-earth than, you know, Legolas is, for example. So I think the Second Age would probably be better set for that. Plus, you wouldn't need quite nearly the amount of the CG budget that you need for the First Age, too.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
That Christopher Tolkien churns out a lot of material.
Mm-hmm.
I give the Frank Herbert's son some grief because he really spun off like some notes they found on the safety deposit box,
mm-hmm.
and gave us, oh, I don't know.
What, like nine new trilogies?
Nine, yeah. Like that. Trilogy after trilogy. And I'm like, I don't think he wrote that many notes. And the same with Tolkien. I was like, okay, I think he published a lot of the stuff. And The Silmarillion, and then The Book of Lost Tales, and then Tales of Middle-earth. And then now there's like 20 books.
Wow.
Like
the
some
well
history
has
of Middle-earth.
Been dry for a long time there.
Yeah.
Hmm.
So I
Was there a sequel to The Lord of the Rings then?
I don't think so.
I'm sure Christopher will find some notes and say, like,
okay,
oh, yeah.
Not in anything other than note form.
I'd actually just read recently that Tolkien had started a sequel to The Lord of the Rings, but he abandoned it pretty quickly afterwards.
I bet all it was a title page.
So Christopher's fleshed it out a bit.
Yeah.
All it is a page that The Lord of the Rings 2.
I've written 10 books!
Yeah. I don't know. But I mean, like, getting back to the TV series idea, I mean, you think about it, they don't even have to follow characters in the book because there's all those, you know, Rangers of the North and the Dunedain guarding the Shire. You could totally do something with that.
Mm.
Or the thing about the Silmarillion and the Second Age, it's all those, like, legends. And yeah, you have those heroic figures, but I mean, you could completely invent stories around those legends that only touch a tiny bit unnamed characters in the Silmarillion.
Yeah.
So I think because it's much less of a tight story the way the Lord of the Rings was, a writer could just have a field day with the Silmarillion and still call it, you know, the Silmarillion.
Yeah. So. And with the Game of Thrones being such a hot series right now, that's a great time to put out some fantasy.
Well, that's what I'm wondering. That's what I'm wondering.
So I guess the answer there is we think we may see Tolkien again on the screen, but maybe not on the big screen.
Then, right. Honestly, I hope so. I that seems like it would be fun. Maybe I'm just imagining it better than it would actually be, but I'd love to see that.
And our final thing, I guess, about movies, and it's not even a movie, but a trailer, but the internet kind of broke when it came out, and that was the trailer for number 7.
Mm-hmm.
And you actually saw that, Wayne, right?
No, I still haven't seen the trailer. Cause...
What?
90 seconds out of your life. Sorry, you're too busy watching movies that you hate.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. You know what? I'd rather watch stuff that looks interesting, but I end up hating, than the Star Wars trailer. So there you go.
We already had an episode on it, which you didn't listen to, about Star Wars. And
right.
Just saying there was a lot of familiar stuff in the trailer. So people were happy. You know what?
And that's exactly why they did it, I bet.
You know, and I didn't even mean to seg into, because we are going to talk about this later. But it's like Dungeons and Dragons 5e.
Right.
So
we should call this Star Wars the apology episode.
Yeah.
No, but you're absolutely right. Like, I'm not having seen the trailer, but...
Well, we could do like a test. So what kind of starships would you want to see in the trailer?
Well, you'd have to see X-Wings. You'd have to see TIE Fighters. You definitely have to see lightsabers. Whatever is going to be the... fill in for stormtroopers, some kind of Sith guy, some kind of Jedi character. Yeah.
I think they got all of that except for maybe the Jedi. They don't.
Yeah, it didn't have the Jedi. They,
okay.
They did have the Millennium Falcon, which you didn't mention.
Right,
but
right, okay.
Pretty much it, yeah.
But I mean, I don't think they could have done anything different because, like, going all the way back to our thing about, you know, sequels do better. Like, this is not a standalone movie. This is, you have to hit those elements for it to be a Star Wars movie. It's set in this universe. You have to give these Star Wars fans what they want to see.
At least for the first one, eh?
I would say for the second one. I would say for all of them.
They're doing kind of leapfrogging years for the sequential Star Wars movies. And in the off years, they're planning to do spin-off movies. We don't know what those are going to be about, but theoretically not about Jedi or the main stories. So.
Well, that's fine, but I mean, like, I think you're still going to have those Star Wars elements. Otherwise, it's not going to be it's not going to be considered a Star Wars movie. You know, like you like Star Trek.
Yeah.
So when they did the Star Trek reboot, there were things that needed to be in that movie for it to be a Star Trek movie for you.
Right, because it's a continuation of the series. But what I'm saying is that if you do a spin-off movie, you might not necessarily have to do that. I could see a movie based entirely off of Klingons or something like that, without any phasers or Enterprises or anything.
Yeah, right, but they would have Klingons.
Yeah, exactly. That's the point. Like, they're by being Klingon,
well,
there are
going to
be things.
This is going to be in the same universe. They're going to have planets and stars, too. I mean, come on.
Oh, come on. Planets and stars. That's a bit broad, but...
No, but they'll have the Klingons, and then they'll have the really Klingon-y things. Mm-hmm. So they might have the Klingon who doesn't act like the others.
Right.
And that would probably be the protagonist, because we would want somebody we could relate to. Mm. But that person is going to be a stand-in for us reacting to the crazy Klingon culture.
Well, obviously, but what I'm saying is that the Star Wars universe is quite large, and there's a lot of things that that Wayne didn't mention that could still be spun off of as Star Wars things. And you wouldn't necessarily need all of the things that were mentioned. For example, you could do one about bounty hunters and skip the Jedi entirely. Like, do it outside of the Rebels. There's still lots of other kinds of ships that you could use without hitting the Millennium Falcon or TIE Fighters or whatnot.
True. I mean, like, maybe Bounty Hunters is, like, a bad example, because, I mean, like, as popular as Boba Fett is and, like, all the Bounty Hunter characters that were around him, even in, you know, episode, what,
did you call him Boba Fett?
Yeah, Boba Fett. That's the way I always pronounce it. Sorry, Boba Fett.
It's Boba.
Oh, excuse me.
Boba Fett.
Whatever. The guy in the Mandalorian battle armor, whatever. The guy who got punked by the Sarlacc.
He's name dropping here.
Cred.
Yeah. Anyway. Point is, like, I was going to say, like, just like Lyle said about, like, the Klingons, even if they do spin-off movies, it's not going to be in some tiny corner of the Star Wars universe that practically nobody knows about, you know, that you look at and it's, you know, debatable whether it's Star Wars or not. Like, they're going to do exactly what Lyle said with the Klingons. Like, there's still going to be stuff that is recognizably Star Wars in those spin-off movies.
Mm-hmm. Using the bounty hunter example, I think you might have huts or a hut.
Right, right.
So, but you're right. I mean, they might not have like an X-wing fighter, but they might have I forget the numerical and designation, but the headhunters.
Z95 headhunter. Bam.
Oh wow! Boom. Mm. Yeah, almost forgive you for Baba.
All right.
So they would have that. But you're right. They wouldn't necessarily have all the core things. But they do need that for the original movie, and probably the core sequel would still need. I mean, it's going to continue that story anyway. But yeah, then the sidetracks, they can start to try new things, and see if those hit. Whereas I guess with the prequels, I mean, yeah, there's a lot wrong with the prequels. But
right.
One of the things was hardly anything was recognizable.
Yeah.
It was like a very clean world,
you know,
a very clean setting.
I hadn't thought of that, but that's a really good point. And you kind of likened it to D&D, you know, like the Apology Edition. Maybe that's what was part of the problem with the prequels, with like 4th edition. Like, this is not really recognizable as Star Wars to a certain extent, because everything is clean, and what are these things I haven't seen before. So, but, like, I wonder, like, if the new Star Wars movies are successful, the way we were talking about how Marvel now has a fan base that allows them to take risks with their movies and do lesser known stories and characters. If Disney intends to keep this thing going, and why would you not? Because Star Wars is that giant cash cow. If these new movies are successful enough, maybe that would open up the doors to doing those obscure storylines or doing more experimental stuff, because they're pretty sure they have the fan base to support it, or at least people will go and check it out because, hey, it's Star Wars.
I don't know. I'm just kind of shooting from the hip here, but I'd say almost that Star Wars already has that fan base.
I think it's some of huge. It got... I don't doubt that. I think a lot of people lost, including myself included, lost face with the prequels.
I was actually just going to correct myself and say, but then again, the prequels kind of ruined that, so maybe I'm wrong.
Prequels kind of use that up, where if these new ones are good enough...
Yeah.
Well, I think they'll follow like the Marvel style, and they'll have the big core films, like the Avenger films,
right?
And then they'll have the little one, the smaller ones, like the Doctor Strange's and the Ant-Man's, where they could experiment, but they'd have to be somewhat connected. Just like Guardians of the Galaxy, you don't have any cameos from any of the other characters, but you got this thing, the Infinity Stone, but they'll do something like that. So in those first spin-off films, they're not just going to go complete bounty hunter that you haven't seen. Mm-hmm.
Right. Right.
There'll be maybe a bounty hunter that was introduced in the main movie, and then we're going to follow more about this person.
Right.
Right.
Maybe even
Boba
Fett.
Right.
Yeah.
All right. Keep saying it. Keep saying it.
But since we're talking about Star Wars, I guess there was the minor controversy of the Black Stormtrooper.
Oh, heaven forbid, the sky is falling.
Right, yes. But that, I'm just using that to segue into our next big thing of 2014, and that was the diversity that we saw in a lot of properties.
Mm-hmm.
So we talked about the Black Captain America, Falcon,
mm-hmm.
And the female Thor.
Mm-hmm.
Thor.
Yes.
No, and of course, Dungeons and Dragons, the controversial, but from the direction that you didn't expect, and that was like talking about gender and sexuality.
Right, right.
Yeah, and people just thought it didn't go far enough, or they didn't like the wording anyway. But it was in there. Yeah, and you didn't hear too many complaints from the other side saying it shouldn't have been included at all.
Right.
Well, I was hearing that. I mean, not exclusively, but yeah. I mean, one side said didn't need to include it at all. The other side said it didn't go far enough. So, yeah.
Right.
But, I mean, I think it, and we've discussed this before, it was something that D&D needed to include, I think, given the climate, or something that looked better expressly said, and yeah, I thought it was fine.
Damning them with faint praise. I thought it was good.
Yeah. Kudos to him. It wasn't the perfectly worded thing, but hell,
oh,
it's
wow.
Great to have it in there.
Just slapping the awesome conditions. Yeah, it's yeah. I won't even slap in the condition. It was good to see.
Just the thing is, you know, I'm in that racial and sexual majority kind of thing, so it's hard for me to actually say with any kind of oomph to my words, you know, but about whether it was enough or not. But like seeing that kind
opinion
of inclusiveness was awesome.
You can have an opinion.
And I do. I think it was great. Okay. But some people were upset about it, so I don't want to like devalue what they're saying. So.
No, but your opinion doesn't devalue somebody else's opinion.
Oh, yeah, I suppose.
It does, okay, according to some people.
It was awesome. So, diversity rules.
Yeah, but yeah, so we saw a few things, so I haven't seen the animated series. I think it's called Korra.
Oh, Legend of Korra.
Oh, yeah.
Legend of Korra. Yeah, one of our friends is a big fan of it, and he was pretty pleased with how it turned out. And then I saw an article where they had a lesbian couple
mm-hmm.
at the end. So, yeah. And they thought that was pretty good. But I don't know, lesbians in some kind of quasi-Japanese anime, I don't know. Is that a big shock? I think Japan has been pioneering that.
Probably more controversial than the lesbian thing is you calling Avatar and Legend of Korra anime. There's a huge debate about that in certain circles.
Well, yeah. Since nobody can actually define what anime is, then meh.
Yeah, exactly. My feeling too, yeah.
What, they're offended somebody would call it anime, or...?
I don't know. It's all kinds of stupid, in my opinion. People say, oh, it's not anime. It can't be anime because it's made in the States, and anime is reserved for stuff made in Japan. And you're just like, oh, whatever, dude.
Well, whatever. It's an animated series that, unless you said that it was made in the States, people would think it was made in Japan.
Right, right.
Yeah, but...
So, lesbian's awesome. Sorry.
Yeah, you're totally down with animated lesbian. I think they just... they showed some screen grabs of it, and that was like a kiss and hand holding. So,
mm-hmm.
Ooh, hand holding, risque.
Well, I mean, though, actually, a kiss is because Avatar and Legend of Korra that is still at least officially a kids show, huh? It was still made through Nickelodeon Networks, wasn't it?
Yes, I believe
so,
it was.
So, I mean, actually, you know, that is kind of news for them.
I thought you had watched Avatar, Chris.
I watched a few episodes of Avatar, but I haven't seen The Legend of Korra at all, so.
I guess I'm in the same boat, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, actually, I stopped watching Avatar because it was a bit kiddish, but I'm thinking about giving another try because of how Clone Wars went.
Okay, okay.
Well, speaking of kiddish, Transformers 3 was on TV, and I'm watching like the last 20 minutes of it, and I'm like, is this still for kids? Can kids watch this Transformers? Because it's Optimus Prime, like, blowing people's heads off.
I don't think it really was ever released for kids. It was released for, you know...
It was released for kids, for people who were kids in the 80s.
Exactly,
yeah.
Exactly.
Okay.
Thank you. Well, you know, just talking about Star Wars and the classic ships, their X-Wings, there's also this year was the big return of some miniatures games, specifically Fantasy Flight's X-Wing.
And a lot of spin-offs.
Yes, yes, and the ever-growing X-Wing.
Yeah, so obviously that's a big success, so they've spun off, or another company has spun off with, like, Attack Wing. Mm-hmm. The Dungeons & Dragons one has just been released.
Yeah, yeah.
Fantasy Flight's going to do Armada and Imperial Assault, so... Yep. But it's definitely capitalizing on the adults. We don't have time to build things.
Mm-hmm.
Which is, I think, one of the reasons why more complicated board games took off. At least Ameritrash games.
Mm-hmm.
Yep, yep. No, I'm wondering, because I was never into the Whiz Kids or the Hero Click stuff, but I wonder if... Well, you definitely have the Star Wars appeal, you know, with Star Wars Attack Wing, or X-Wing, right?
Yeah.
Because,
yeah.
I mean, they had a built-in market right there, even if people weren't gamers. But I wonder if they approached it, being Fantasy Flight, if they approached it more as a game rather than the collectible angle. And if that's what's helped it stick so far.
I think that's a good point, because one of the big differences between X-Wing and the WizKids games was... The fact that you know what you're buying with the Fantasy Flight games.
Mm-hmm.
So you go and you buy an X-Wing or a TIE Fighter. You don't buy a pack with four ships in it and you don't know what four they're going to be.
Right.
Now, of course, if you have Marvel superheroes or DC superheroes, there's so many characters that you can have that you can have a collectible range. Whereas like with Star Wars, I mean, you got like X-Wing, TIE Fighter, a B-Wing, an A-Wing, so you can't really do, what's going to be in here.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, four A-Wings. Yeah. So, even the Dragon one, I believe D&D Miniatures used to do the collectible where you didn't know what was inside the box.
I think all you knew was how many of a certain size you were going to get.
Right.
Yeah, and what miniatures were in that series. And with their new miniatures game, it's like clear bubble packs. So you know exactly what you're getting and the condition that you're getting it.
Mm-hmm.
So. Bent swords and sloppy leaping faces.
But you know that going in, right. You know. Yeah.
Yeah.
So.
Hey, you know what? I was thinking today, like, I don't know that. The Dungeons & Dragons Attack Wing, if that's what it's called, does not excite me at all. But thinking today, like, hey, Dungeons & Dragons is more than just a role-playing game brand, you know? There's those board games. I'm sure they've got, like, you know, video games, like online, like cell phone games, iOS games, and now they've got Attack Wing. So I'm sure there are people out there who have only experienced Dungeons & Dragons through something other than the role-playing game.
And, you know, I'd actually like to give it a try, because I'm assuming it has the same mechanics as X-Wing does, and that's a very fun game to play just mechanically. And I like dragons. So.
It probably has the same movement mechanics.
Mm.
I don't know. It seems a bit Johnny-come-lately. Part of me thinks, great, yeah, more power to you. Another part of me thinks, Spellfire. You know, D&D's attempt at magic.
Right.
Before Magic bought D&D, or TSR.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
We mentioned it enough in this episode, but definitely one of the big, or the big tabletop gaming news, or gaming event, was the release of D&D 5th Edition.
Mm-hmm.
Right. I actually saw the books when I was in a Barnes & Noble over in Los Angeles, and they were nice-looking books to the point where I actually considered getting the trio for a split second.
You, of all people.
Yeah, I was just based on the cover, I'm like, yeah, okay, there's nice books. I'm here, they're there, should I get them? Maybe? No. Yeah. It's kind of like that, yeah. Just based on who put it out and the name, it was going to be big news. And, you know, me being my pessimistic self, I think it hasn't really been around long enough to determine whether it's going to be decent or not.
Well, you know, I mean, the rules look good. And it hits those key points that are D&D, much like the Star Wars trailer seems to be doing. So, yeah, I mean, awesome, yay, woo. And I would like to play, but at the same time, yeah, I'm okay that I haven't played it yet.
Yeah, I'm trying to think back to when 4th Edition came out and whether people had started complaining about stuff or saying this wasn't great yet, you know,
straight away.
How much? Yeah, straight away.
Yeah, I mean, it really split people. Now, when second edition came out, or when third edition came out, I mean, the internet wasn't the thing that it is now, obviously.
Right.
So you might not hear the conversations that were going on in gaming stores, and it's. But definitely, when fourth edition came out, the internet was enough of a thing that it seemed very divisive and kind of split the hobby. But me, mm-hmm. I mean, there's still people that play first edition, so every edition split people.
Right,
right, right.
Yeah, with fifth edition, it seems more people are more happy with it than people are unhappy with it.
Mm-hmm.
Although you still see people occasionally going, "Well, I'm upgrading my second edition game to third edition." And you're like, "Why?" Like, I did not have a problem with 3rd edition D&D. I liked it. It actually brought me back into Dungeons & Dragons.
Right.
And I really loved the things that it introduced to the system. But if I don't see upgrading from something that's, I don't know, 20 years old to something that's 15 years old.
Yeah, right. It's kind of...
You know, I don't see this as an upgrade, you know.
You've been happy with 2nd edition for the past 20 years. Why now?
Yeah, I want to upgrade from my 8-track to a cassette player. Could anybody recommend some a good cassette player? Just like... But no, I think exactly what we're talking about with the Star Wars, it's familiar enough, and they did some good things, like with the big play testing, so everybody felt, people felt like they had a voice. The design of it, the look of it, I mean, even seeing, mm-hmm. what's your favorite cover?
Mm-hmm.
You know, oh, everybody likes 2nd edition. Okay, this is going to look like 2nd edition.
Right.
The interior looks like a, you know, 3rd edition mixed with 4th edition mixed with 2nd edition, so.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it really was the committee edition. What do you want to see?
Oh, we'll, I like that. Committee edition. Yeah.
One book to rule them all.
Yeah, or less, you know, less flattering, D&D, the Neckbeard Voice Edition, which, yeah, so far seems to be doing well.
Mm-hmm.
I would have been very surprised if it didn't, just based on name alone, you know.
I don't know, like, there was enough bad blood and edition argument that I could have seen it failing pretty spectacularly, especially with other takers for the franchise out there, like Pathfinder.
I don't think so. I think as much time as there had been from, you know, there being a new edition of D&D, or mm-hmm. from when they pulled support for 4th edition. And I think, yeah, no matter what they put out, I mean, unless it was absolute crap, even if it was mediocre, mm-hmm. we'd probably be seeing the response that we are now. Because I don't think it's been around long enough for it really to be, like, picked apart or to see what happens with it.
Well, sales-wise, I think expectations are lower. Because I think people have lower expectations when it comes to releasing role-playing games. But I think, you know, I agree with Chris a little bit. Like, Pathfinder has a significant following and enough of a presence that you would see Pathfinder's books in a Chapters or a Barnes & Noble.
Mm-hmm.
And there are some up-and-coming games, like 13th Age, that are going to capture the people that really like the 4th edition style.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And that actually would have made one of our big gaming events, or one of our personal gaming events, was the release of 13th Age, but that came out in 2013.
Right.
Yeah, but I think Dungeons & Dragons is just the big enough name. I mean, like, Dungeons & Dragons is completely interchangeable with role-playing games to the point where people say, oh, it's like D&D, but in space. It's like D&D, but in the Old West. You know, it's like D&D, but wherever.
I get what you're saying, but...
I think anything coming out would have had the reaction it had now.
No, a positive reaction, but I'm just talking about, like, a sales success and whether or not it's performing to the extent that it could. Like, The Hobbit, The Battle of the Five Armies, is doing well. It's making its money back, but it's underperforming compared to the other movies.
Right.
So.
Well, I don't have anything, obviously. I don't know what Wizards wanted it to do, and unlike The Hobbit, like, it's not like we have, well, I guess we do, prior editions of D&D, but it's not like we can, if you looked at, well, maybe the release of the Player's Handbook, the Monster Manual, and the Dungeon Master's Guide, are sales tapering off when you get to the Dungeon Master's Guide already. And if so, is that worrying, or are things picking up? Like, are you seeing a spike in sales of the DMG, or are things holding steady?
That's a good point. I know we talked about the starter box, and people just went crazy about the starter box.
Yeah, there's a starter box too, yeah.
And pre-ordering that, but I'd like to see the presence of the starter box next year. Or yeah. In 2016, are we still going to see those around? Or
yeah, I don't know. Maybe we won't even see the starter box. Maybe that was just something to hold people over until the books came out.
That could have been the hooker.
Yeah.
But, you know, I kind of disagree with what you were saying a moment ago, Wayne, in that you're right that D&D has an enormous name power, but that's among kind of society as a whole. I think that D&D's actual power among gamers is considerably less. Because among gamers, everybody knows the name D&D, but if you're a tabletop gamer and you play fantasy, you also know the name Pathfinder. And I think those are the people that you have to sell to. So, granted, you know, you say D&D and everybody knows what you're talking about, whether they're a gamer or not, but if they are gamers, there's quite a bit more competition, and those are the people who are actually going to buy products.
Maybe there's more competition, but on Twitter and like Google+, I've seen enough gamers say, I'm going to check out D&D 5th Edition just because it's D&D, and how can I not to disagree with that?
Yeah, true.
I think it has just as much pull in the gamer circle as it does in the public.
There's that one group we follow on Facebook, too, and what is it, like 95% of the conversations revolve around D&D.
Yeah, so, it's the new kid. It's the new kid on the block in terms of edition, and it's D&D.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, a lot of the conversations are about D&D, but different editions of it.
True.
Except for 4th edition, we don't see a lot of posts on that, and most of the majority are on 5th edition now. But still, people again. I mean, that's where we saw people talking about upgrading to 3rd edition.
Right. Right.
I can see both your points because certainly. Like, Superman is synonymous with superhero. Mm. And you're talking about, like, a superhero movie, but I don't know how many people went to see Man of Steel.
Mm-hmm.
Like, Superman movies don't perform as well as other superhero movies. And the comic books don't perform that well. And we talked about reasons why, but just because the general public is familiar with a property doesn't necessarily translate into sales.
Mm-hmm.
Very true.
I mean, certainly there's a lot of evidence out there that as you said, Wayne, the general gaming population seems to have embraced this D&D 5th edition, and a lot of people are like, oh, yeah, why not? I'll give it a shot, because it's Dungeons & Dragons, and it'd be a shame not to try this edition, because I try every edition when it comes
out.
Right.
But whether or not that's really translating into sales, like, are they going out and buying the set of three? You didn't.
Right.
And I know you bought 3rd edition. And 4th edition, I remember we ordered those together and we bought like the set of three.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, and it, you know, just didn't think about it. We just knew, oh, Chris is running a 4th edition game, so we'll buy the 4th edition books.
Hmm. Yeah.
And whether or not people are trying it and actually buying it, or trying it out because somebody else has got the books and they're going to run the game. And I'm wondering, and I thought you raised a good point about, I liked the staggered release, because I thought the rationale behind it was really good. We just can't ensure the quality if we release them all at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
So we want to make sure to give each book its own attention.
Yeah.
But our sales tapering off with the enthusiasm, and I know they were trying to really pump the Dungeon Master's Guide, but that's not a sexy book.
No, well, and also I guess there's a flaw in what I was saying about, are we seeing a spike in sales for the DMG, or are we seeing tapering off? Because the player's handbook is for everybody. The monster manual is geared for the DM, but players get that too. They want to know what monsters they're going to face. The DMG, not everybody is going to buy that. One of the other kind of big news things that was actually brought up by Lyle was the Powered by the Apocalypse games. In 2014, we saw a big spike of games that were powered by the Apocalypse. I mean, mm-hmm. We did the interview for Spirit of 77. We did the interview for The Sprawl. I backed Night Witches. There's a whole bunch of other ones that I've missed, have now flown out of my head. So I think this is a year where that system, for lack of a better word, kind of really took off.
Mm-hmm.
Or a lot of people started jumping on the bandwagon of its popularity.
It seems to be the new Fate, or the new Savage Worlds, and before that, the new Ogle. OGL.
I was like, what? What?
Oh, okay.
Yeah. I don't think it's to the extent that any of those other things that you mentioned are, but at least for smaller games, or, you know, things that aren't like Hasbro and Wizards of the Coast and D&D and, you know, all those big properties. Yeah, I think that's the go-to system.
Well, it is. I mean, it's a fairly easy system. You can generally write out the rules that everyone needs to know on one or two pages.
Yeah, not to get into it. It is and it isn't. Like,
yeah, you're right.
Someone was asking, okay, is, like, you know, because I push Dungeon World on everybody, right? So they were asking, okay, is there a generic Apocalypse World game? And I said, no, because usually the system and the things you write, kind of the rules for the game, the moves, are so tied to whatever setting or type of game you're playing that there kind of can't be a generic one.
Yeah, it'd be impossible to make a generic.
Yeah, it's not like GURPS where you can just turn on and off these switches. It's the system itself is very simple, yeah, but it's tied into the fiction and the genre of whatever you're doing so much that it is kind of difficult to set up.
Yeah, well, I think if you're talking about it from the creation angle, if you're making one of the games, then it's incredibly difficult because the moves are tied specifically into the genre and what the players are doing. And to balance those through the game is really hard. But the mechanics themselves are quite simple.
No, but I think that's a good point, and maybe why we're seeing so many of them now, because now that there are, you know, Apocalypse World, Dungeon World, Monster Hearts, Monster of the Week, there are a lot of examples of what people have done with it. Mm-hmm. And the fact that it is kind of like the OGL, where, you know, the guy who created it, Vincent Baker, is very free in letting people use that system.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I think those are some of the reasons why we're seeing a lot of them this year.
Mm-hmm.
Just ease of accessibility and decent examples.
Mm-hmm.
So people kind of say, why wouldn't I use this to build a game?
Now it just seems like Powered by Apocalypse is popping up, and whether or not it will still be the Kickstarter darling that it is now in 2015. I don't know.
I wonder. Yeah, I mean, people may get sick of it.
But I have to admit, I really hope so. I mean, I've played all of the recent indie darlings. I love Fate. I didn't like Savage Worlds as much, but I think Apocalypse World is such a fantastic game. I love how free and open it is to play and to pick up. I don't think it's quite as long-standing compared to other systems for long-running games, at least from the experience that I've had playing. It doesn't seem to lend itself as well to that. But still, as far as creating games and things along that line, that's just such a great game. I really hope that it has a really long lifespan.
Well, it's not like we're talking about it like it's Dungeons & Dragons, right, where it has like a really long lifespan. But, I mean, it's not like a progression from one game to another.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of different. It's more, I don't know, I'm not trying to sound like all hippie here, but it seems more organic, where it's like, here's this thing, you can use it however you want, and the games that get made with it kind of form this loose family just because of the similarities that they have.
Right.
But it's not like the OGL, where you have to use this core set of rules.
Right, right.
And if that core set of rules dies, then all these other games die too. It's more like Apocalypse World could go out of print, and I'm sure there would still be hacks of it popping up, you know?
I'm sure there would. I'm just wondering if it would, you know, I mean, if it would be as popular as Common. And it's like Savage Worlds or like Fate-esque games, and they become the thing, and everybody talks about how great they are, and then people move on to something else.
I think it'll kind of be popular until that new thing pops up, you know?
I have a feeling it'll be like Fate, where it'll keep a really strong group of core fans, and there will still be things made about it far into the future, but I think it will finish its time as the indie darling.
I mean, I think it's fair enough like to say that I've probably seen as many Fate-based Kickstarter games this year as I've seen Apocalypse World stuff.
Yeah, like, and that's cool, too, because yeah, Fate rules.
But how many of them did you buy? Because it seems like you bought every Powered by Apocalypse.
I did up until I hit Tremulous, and then I'm like, okay, being powered by the Apocalypse doesn't mean it's going to be good. And now I'm a
it
bit
was
more
your Phantom Menace.
Not my Phantom Menace. I think that was my Attack of the Clones, where you're like, okay, it wasn't just me.
That's a great illusion there.
Well, that ends our episode on what we thought were the big gaming and geek events of 2014. Was it the same as your list?
All right, well, thank you for joining us again on Out of Red Hands. Check us out online at www.idleredhands.com, outofredhands.com. You can listen to the episode right there on the website or stream it through iTunes or Stitcher or download it off of DriveThruRPG. You can plus one us on G+, you can like us on Facebook, you can follow us on Twitter, or you can join up and talk to us in our forums. Those are at idleredhands.com/forums and are hosted by Happy Jacks. Thank you very much, guys. Or you can send us an email at info@idleredhands.com. Thanks a lot, and see you next time.
Bye.
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 Drive Through RPG. We average 9 new titles a day. That's over 60 a week. And we've got well over 15,000 RPG titles online right now. Drive Through RPG. The one true source for RPGs.
Kobe, Japan. See us online at www.idleredhands.com. Music provided by Tripod Jimmy, and the song was Roadkill. Hope you enjoyed it. See you next time.